Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the church.
I'm Nathan Wright, and you're listening to the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Settling the Great Basin region of the American Mountain West was no small feat. It required the vision of prophets and the belief in that vision of the tens of thousands that followed. One of those early pioneers whose remarkable story we'll discuss today was George Washington Bean. And here to lead us through that remarkable life is family historian and great-granddaughter, Vicki Bean Topliff. Vicki, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Longtime Legacy listeners will remember Vicki from our episode about Willard and Rebecca Bean, who served a 25-year mission in Palmyra, New York. But before we get into today's subject, please take a minute, Vicki, and tell us a little bit about yourself, if you would.
Maybe I will say that my writing is probably a result of a church calling I had in Huntington Beach when they called me to be the editor of the Stake newsletter. I didn't know how to write. I didn't know what I was going to do with that. So I went to the library, which we did in those days, and studied and just came up with some ideas. And before I knew it, I was writing newspaper articles and then magazine articles. The editor of a magazine called Mormon Sport back then asked me to do a few stories. And so anyway, I started doing that sort of thing. But then in 1980, I realized I had a lot of stuff about my grandfather, Willard Bean, and I wanted all those stories saved for my children. So I have seven children that I raised in Huntington Beach, California. So I started then, and that book became pretty widely known because we sent it back to Palmyra, and Willard was on this 25-year mission back there, so the stories have spread far and wide. But so since then, I so enjoyed doing those stories, and I did it when I moved to Utah 15 years ago. I found that there were a lot more resources for me here, even about Grandpa, about Willard. And so I thought I would get all of his works together, and I wrote a 2-volume book about everything I could find about Willard. But then there's George, who's Willard's dad, and I found the life stories or life sketches of his 30 children. I thought, oh, I must combine all that into a book for my kids, too. So I really do all of this for posterity. I want them to have the great stories about their pioneer ancestors.
And being such a, we'll find out, prominent pioneer ancestor, this is great for the rest of us as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the early years of George Washington Bean, perhaps his parents, where he was born, etc.
He was born in Minden, Illinois, in 1831. His parents were James and Elizabeth Bean, and they farmed back there. George was always anxious to learn things. He was referred to as Pa's shadow by the folks back there, and he learned everything he could about farming and cattle raising and so on. One day, a man came to town by the name of Alexander Williams. He was one of the Mormon exiles from Missouri, and he decided to stay there. He wanted to get a little education, and there was a fine school there. So he got to know the Bean family really well, and he taught them about the gospel, and they were baptized. George was 10 at the time. They were baptized in 1841. So that's where that all started, and very soon after that, they all moved to Nauvoo.
So a lot of things took place in Nauvoo for the Bean family. What was George's involvement there in Nauvoo?
Well, George immediately went to work on the Nauvoo Temple. He said he spent most of his time on the roof and the tower. He was handling timbers up there. He was 14 years old at this time. So he worked at that, but he was big for his age. And when they were gathering people for the Nauvoo Legion, he was called to participate in that. When he got back, he was on night guard duty at the Nauvoo Temple. I guess his size was intimidating enough, even though he was just 14 years old. Also, while he was still 14, he was ordained a 70 and also was able to receive his endowments in the Nauvoo Temple all before he was 15 years of age.
Do we know if this was common or just that he was outstanding because of his...
Well, I think he was outstanding. It may have been normal, too, as far as getting your endowments before they were forced out of the city, but I don't know. But he was just a youngster.
So let's talk about some of the things that happened on the trek west.
He did help led a lot of companies, as it turned out. He was back and forth some in going to Salt Lake City. One of my favorite stories is about him and a kid named Gabe Mayberry. Now, at this time, he was 16 years old, and I assume that Gabe was probably the same age. But he said that in his journal, he records that the traveling conditions were far from ideal, and there were a lot of grumbling, a lot of rebellion going on. Well, I guess they were having trouble getting off on time every morning, and so I'll read this straight from his journal because it's really cute. The night before my combat with Gabe, our captain decided to correct the slowness of the certain ones who kept the rest of us waiting so often by saying that the first one in line the next morning could lead our company. This 16-year-old boy was up and ready and in place ahead of lazy Gabe. My conscience was clear as I won my place, but it angered him and he began to wreak vengeance upon my oxen. I leaped to the rescue of my faithful friends and fairly shouted, "You can beat me if you like, but not my oxen." He lashed away at them again, and I cracked him over the head with the butt of my ox whip. I worried for days about a court-martial, but my prayers were answered. When he did go in for this, what was expected to be a court-martial, the outcome turned out to be a very pleasant one for him. Jedediah M. Grant, who was the counselor to Brigham Young at the time and also was Heber J. Grant's father, but he came to his rescue by saying that he felt to honor the lad who would fight in defense of his team if need be, and that a man should be punished for laziness if possible instead of putting a premium on it. So he and the testimony of John Young made it possible for George to walk forth a free lad. He says, "How thankful and grateful I did feel. Here was I, a lone boy of 16, far away from parents and kindred, brought to trial for an act that was just as natural for a boy of spirit as it was to breathe. And just at the time that all hope was lost to get some relief from the highest authority at that time, well, suffice it to say, that judgment was not rendered, and I walked forth a free lad, and my good old Captain Vance never afterwards required me to travel behind Gabe Mayberry." I'm sure that was a good thing. So George, the group that George was with at that time entered the Salt Lake Valley on October 4th, 1847.
He also helped a sister across the plains. What are some other stories that you may have?
He did, and I don't have that all firm in my mind, but I know his sister Sarah Ann had a baby, and I know he went back and helped them across the plains. And then I know even after that, Brigham Young sent him back to help still others, and he made sure he got all of his family members to Salt Lake. I know also, I recall that he was part of a group of people that got some of the general authorities, some of the leaders, onto ferry boats so they could get across the Mississippi. So there was a lot of activity going on, and he was involved in all of it.
Excellent. So what happened when he finally made it here to the West and decided to stay?
There's a few wonderful stories about when he was first here. Let's start with the Indians. When they came, of course, to the Salt Lake Valley, there were plenty of Indians around. And Brigham Young called Porter Rockwell and George to his office and asked if they would go together to see if they could bring peace between the Indians and the Saints. And he sent them and said with a message of friendship, peace. That's what Brigham wanted to let the Indians know. So they went. George was a little nervous about it. Porter, he says, carried a gun all the time, but George didn't. But anyway, so they went. And they got to this reservation and they could see them in the distance. And there was a lot of activity. There was a bonfire and all the Indians were dancing around it and hooping and hollering so they stopped a ways out and they watched and they kind of discussed, okay, how are we going to do this? They decided that if they both rode in on horseback, they'd probably both be killed. So Porter suggested that George be the one to go in after they discussed it. And he says, "George, you go to the camp alone. You know the language and maybe some of the Indians. Your personality is better than mine, too." I thought that was cute. "I'll hide in these willows, ready to rush to get you when you give the signal." So George started in, and I think at this time, he was still just 18 years old now, and there a couple saw him as he was approaching, and they went right out and got him and tied his hands behind his back and took him into the camp and stood him on a buffalo robe, where he stood for 2 hours. He wasn't allowed to speak. He just stood and watched them dance and hoop and holler, and he could understand some of the Indian language at that time, and he knew that they were talking about the whites that had invaded their land. And pretty soon the dancing stopped, and they were just looking at him and giving him a chance to speak. Well, fortunately, he did know a little of their language, and he could understand everything, pretty much everything they were saying. And they seemed to get the message that, okay, these white people intend to be friendly. And so they went over and they untied him, and they walked out with him out to where Porter Rockwell was. And, of course, Porter, after 2 hours, had assumed that they had killed George. And he saw them walking out and wasn't sure what was really happening. But then Porter was able to give them the same message from Brigham Young, saying, you know, calling him the Great White Chief. And it seemed to make them feel better. And then that did really help their relationship with the Indians after that. And in fact, there were times that the Indians actually came to George's rescue after that. They became pretty good friends.
As a reminder to our listeners, this is Legacy on the Mormon Channel. We're in Orem, Utah, talking with Vicki Bean Topliff about the life and times of her great-grandfather, George Washington Bean. There aren't many who can say they've founded a major Western U.S. city, but George Washington Bean is one of them. Tell us which one.
Brigham Young asked him to go down with a couple other men down south of Salt Lake City so they could settle another community down there. So George actually is the one with those few others who founded Provo. And it was, it turns out, on his 18th birthday, April 1st, and that would have been in 1849. An interesting story I found later, and this would have been years after this, but apparently the fathers in the of Provo couldn't seem to settle on a date that Provo was founded. And in George's journal, which they came upon, they found that it was on his 18th birthday, and they figured a boy on his 18th birthday is going to remember what happened that day. So that was really what they realized. It was then founded on April 1st. However, they didn't want it to be forevermore on April Fool's Day. So I think now they've settled on April 3rd, and that's what they consider the day that Provo was actually founded.
George had an accident which affected him for the rest of his life. And tell us what brought that on and how he dealt with it.
Okay. When they were down in Provo, they'd been there perhaps a few months, but they did have dealings with the Indians there, and they knew that that would be ongoing for a while. So the Saints built a platform that they mounted a cannon on top of, and they built a fort around it just in case there were future problems. But so this Lieutenant William Dayton was up there with the cannon, and he thought it would be fun to kind of have a test fire, you know. There were several people around, and George was walking by. He said, George, come on up here with me and help me with this test fire. And so they fired at once, and everything went well. It was very exciting. Everybody loved it. And Lieutenant Dayton said, well, let's do another one. But unfortunately, he failed to swab the gun before he set it off again, and then there was this horrific explosion. It threw both George and Lieutenant Dayton 30 feet in the air. Lieutenant Dayton was killed outright. George landed further away and was dying. It blew his hand right off. He was really a mess. His eyes and face were black with the powder, and they were burned so bad that he lost his sight. There were splinters and powder burn all over his body. His hand was found in the yard of Celia Hunt, and she recognized it by the band ring on his finger. They got him back home. They were able to get him home. He was still breathing, but he was in horrible shape. They got him home, and then, of course, his parents were more than concerned, and it took a long time for a doctor to get there, but I know in the morning, finally, when daylight came, the doctor got to the house, and he checked him out and was rather horrified with how bad everything was. And one of the things he had to do was saw his arm off. Kind of reminds me of Joseph Smith's experience, because the doctor sent everybody out of the room except a couple of his aides and his father. So I'm sure with his father holding him in his arms, the doctor was able to saw through that arm and cut his arm off. And it left him with a 3.5-inch stump just below the elbow, which he said served him well the rest of his life. But even while he was convalescing, Indians would come, and some that were friends, and he could teach them more of the English language, and they could teach him more of the Indian language. About 3 weeks later, after the doctor had taken care of him and done what he could do, well, his sight had still not come back, and he had scabs over his whole body, and the doctor had had to pull out splinters as well. His body was full of splinters, and the doctor was anxious to get the ones out of his chest and neck, anything that would affect vital organs, so they worked on those first. But at one point, about 3 weeks after the accident, Brigham Young came to the house with his two counselors, which were Heber C. Kimball and Willard Richards. And George, of course, couldn't see, but he recognized their voices because he'd heard them preach sermons, and he was aware they were talking to his mother. And his mother asked Brigham Young if he thought that George could live, and he said yes, he did. President Young went over and took George's hand and asked him if he wanted to live. And prior to that, George had not wanted to live. He was praying to die because he was in such misery. There was no, of course, anesthetic or any kind of pain medication in those days. So when Brigham asked George if he wanted to live, George's response was, "I do if I can be of any value." And so Brigham said, "Well, then you shall live." And the three of them laid their hands on his head and gave him a blessing, and it was very sweet, and he recorded much of it in his journal and wished that he had had a recording so he could have remembered all of it. But the next day, the scales and scabs fell from his eyes, and he could see for the first time in 20 days. He was still convalescing for at least 40 days at home. But he did go on to do incredibly marvelous things after that for someone who had been through what he had been through.
So, as he said, he went on. This didn't stop him in any fashion. He went on and was able to marry. He came up with some ways to deal with his disability, shall we say?
Yeah, he did. There was a cute report. He developed a utensil. It had a wood handle and then a curved blade, and then tongs on the end of the blade so that he could, you know, cut with the curved part and then use the fork to eat with. He said, you know, if he was out with the cowboys or the workmen, you know, he could eat whatever way he wanted out there. He could use his hands. But when he was in the house with his wife and family, he thought that he wanted to clean up his act a little bit. And so he created that utensil. And he said he never patented it. He never had any desire to do that. But he said it was written up in several places, and every time whoever was writing the article would give him credit for creating that knife-fork combination.
And just so people can get a better idea of what that utensil, that device looks like, we'll definitely put a picture of that on the website. So tell us about his wife. Shall we say first wife?
Yes, that's right. It's his first wife. She was a darling little gal that he... that when she came to town, he happened to come into the office where he was working, and he just she came in with her sister, but he said he just fell immediately for this lovely Elizabeth Baum was her name, and they got married in 1853, and later 3 years later actually Brigham Young came to George and asked him to be involved in plural marriage. Well, he was I'm sure not initially happy to have to do that, but he went home and talked to Elizabeth, and they talked about it a lot. He counseled with her to see, make sure it was fine with her, and her response was, "I know the principle as designed by God is correct if lived righteously, but if you can't do that, stay out of it. If you can, I am agreed." So they decided that they would go ahead and do this, and George married Emily Hawes in December, and December 10th, 1856, and then married Mary Jane Wall just 5 days later on December 15th. But Elizabeth had agreed with his choices, and she stood by George's side during those ceremonies. So the combination then of three wives, George had 30 children. Three of them did die in infancy, but 27 of them were valiant members of the church. Some lived in the United Order. They had learned to farm, and the husbands and the wives were very, very active, not only in the church, but in their communities.
So can you tell us a little more about George's involvement in the United Order?
You know, I don't know much about his involvement. I read some things about the kids, and you know, just from their own stories, and I saw that for some it worked, and for some it didn't. Some were, you know, disenchanted, which I suppose is the way it was just generally with the United Order. But there were some who actually were living in the United Order, and then they decided to leave. I think down in Prattville is where most of the family members were that were involved. I don't have a great deal of information on that. I have the life sketches of all 30 of those children, and I was excited to read those, and I saw how well they were taught. I know one of the things George always advised his children, he said, never refuse to do service in the church. It's the best school in the world. I thought that was such marvelous advice, and they all turned out to be very active in the church, very active probably in their communities as well. They were known for their integrity, so that the dealings even with the Indians, they were comfortable with that because they knew they could trust the Bean children. So, frankly, I'm glad to be part of that Bean bloodline because I'm related to a lot of really marvelous people.
And if our listeners have any interest, want to know some more about the United Order or the Law of Consecration, you're welcome to listen to episodes 20 and 21 of the program Past Impressions. So George was involved quite a bit, as you say, with the Indians, and eventually at one point was an interpreter for the court. And he, from this, wanted to study law. What happened with that?
Well, I know he did study law. He had a lot to do in that field. He became the Superior Court judge in the state of Utah. He was a state legislator. He was a U.S. deputy marshal. He was a prosecuting attorney in the district court, tax assessor, Indian interpreter. I marvel when I read all these things because besides that, he was a counselor in the state presidency, and then he was a patriarch. And I cannot comprehend even having three wives and 30 children and being this active in the government of the area and in the church, and it boggles my mind, frankly.
As I was discussing with Matt, our producer, on the way down here, it's amazing what you can accomplish when you don't have TV and Facebook.
There you go. I have to say, I agree with that. Yeah, that's when kids had something to do, too, and that was a wonderful thing, yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about some of the callings he had in the church.
Let me say one thing here, because I'd like to quote this little bit.
Sure.
He was in being involved in polygamy. He also had to deal with the fact that the government outlawed it, and so I know that he asked for permission from the presiding bishopric to go to Rexburg, Idaho. He was there for three. I'm thinking it was 3 months, is all, just to kind of get away while it was all going on. But then he really missed his family, and he came back. But then at one point they did round him up, shall we say, and took him to court. But this is what he had to say in his journal about this, and I thought it was excellent. Bishop John E. Booth was the attorney at law, and he arose and addressed the court in George's defense. And this is what George said about that later. George says he recited in graphic language the trials and hardships of this man in crossing the plains with ox teams in 1847. And as a Utah pioneer, aged 16, who helped build the first two forts in Utah, in Salt Lake City and Provo, he had been a guide and Indian interpreter for state and government officials, had risked his life many times in teaching the Indians and assisting in their treaties, had held many offices in city and county, had been U.S. deputy marshal when danger lurked at every turn, had been prosecuting attorney in the district court and done much civic work, etc., and was judge in this county when this courthouse in which you are holding court was built. He proceeded to point out that George had done all his marrying as early as 1856 before there was a law prohibiting it. Judge Judd, who was presiding in the courtroom, said, "Mr. Bean, this law was not made for cases like yours, but you have been indicted and plead guilty. Therefore, the case must be disposed of. I fine you $50 and hope you will return home and continue to be a good citizen." He said he paid the fees, but others that were convicted paid a lot more than he did and got a lot, you know, got time behind bars and so on. So he was grateful for that, to just pay a fine. But I guess they could see how much he had done for the county, for the city, for everyone by working with the Indians and so on. So how could they possibly have thought that they should put him in jail?
Wow. Are there any other George Washington Bean stories you'd like to share with us?
Well, I'll just say that he was personally acquainted with four of the presidents of the church, with Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor, and Wilford Woodruff. he was an avid reader of the Bible and apparently could, like his son Willard Bean, my grandfather, could ably lecture on its contents anytime, anywhere. He was set apart as first counselor to President Siegmiller of the severe stake by President, or by Apostle John W. Taylor. Served there and then became a patriarch. His wife was Stake Relief Society president. I mean, they were all very, very involved. She made all their clothes and all of these sort of things. It was said by some scriptorian that George could quote scriptures till the cows come home. He was willing and capable and eager to work. And that's the same kind of thing that I learned about all of his children, too. Eager and capable and ready to work. And he trained his children well, especially by saying, never refuse service in the church. It's the best school in the world.
And evidenced by your great work in putting together this amazing history. So
Thank you so much.
We've been discussing the life of Mormon pioneer George Washington Bean on Legacy Today. Our guest has been Vicki Bean Topliff. Thank you, Vicki, for your time.
Certainly.
I'm Nathan Wright, and this is Legacy on the Mormon Channel, a media outlet of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Nathan Wright, and you're listening to The Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We invite you to listen to new episodes of Legacy Saturdays at 1 o'clock. You can also download any Legacy episode at mormonchannel.org.